You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a Wisconsin woman who's completed a test of strength, planning skills, and a strong mind. Our guest will talk about her summit at the world's tallest mountain outside of Asia. First, at least 127 people in the city of Milwaukee have been diagnosed with HIV or syphilis in a sexually transmitted infection outbreak. Health department officials are calling the outbreak a cluster because the cases are linked in time and place within the same social network. It's one of the largest outbreaks discovered in the city. Mike Gifford joins us now. He's the president and chief executive officer of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Can you talk about what we know about this outbreak, this cluster, as health officials are calling it?
Yeah, certainly what we know is that the number of kids that are dealing with HIV and STI is on a rise in Milwaukee, and that is really significant news. And we're seeing things like the gonorrhea rate in the city of Milwaukee increasing by 38% over the last several years, and Milwaukee sadly has the distinction of having the highest rate of gonorrhea infections anywhere in the country. So a really urgent issue has been identified by this cluster being reported.
And is it unusual to see a cluster like this, 100-some people in the same social network? Is that unusual, or is this something we see happening from time to time?
I think that this is somewhat unusual, the size of it, right? There's 76 people of the 126 who've been diagnosed with either HIV or sexually transmitted infection, an STI. So the size of it, the breadth of it, is a bit unusual. But I think it also reminds us that this is a problem that our young people, any sexually active young person can be at risk for, right? Let's not kid ourselves. State data shows that between 40 and 50% of high school age kids are sexually active, and there are consequences for that. They put themselves at risk for STIs, whether it's gonorrhea or syphilis or chlamydia, and HIV. This needs to be a clarion call for us all to do more to protect the young people in our society.
You mentioned high rates of at least some STDs in Milwaukee. Do we know why Milwaukee?
You know, it's not unique to Milwaukee. Since this cluster has been reported, there's been a report out of Western Pennsylvania of something very similar. We know nationally that over the last 5 years, as an example, the rate of syphilis in this country has gone up 75 or 80%. Unfortunately, we are raising a generation of young people who are ignorant to their risks of HIV and STIs, right? Sadly, HIV in this day and age is taught more from the perspective of maybe a history textbook than a health textbook. And we're not equipping our young people with either the knowledge and information they need nor access to the materials they need to protect themselves from HIV, especially condoms. To get an HIV test is not an easy thing to be tested for in this state. So there's many things that we need to do better to respond to this news.
Talking to Mike Gifford from the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. And Mike, before we get into a little more on the solution side of things, I've seen people make the case that, so there's a good news story in that HIV, it's much more treatable than it used to be. It's not the automatic death sentence. That's good that it used to be, but that's taking it off the radar of a lot of people, and the precautions we used to take, people maybe don't think we need to take that seriously anymore. What do you think?
Yeah, there certainly is a challenge that the good news in the fight against HIV, which is there are effective treatments. There are now medications people can take that can help prevent them from contracting HIV in the first place. I mean, those are all good news things, but HIV continues to be a terribly difficult disease to live with, and I think people are unaware of that, right? You have to remember that HIV is a disease that impoverishes people who are living with HIV. 90% of the people that we serve at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin have an income that they're in poverty. They have significant mental health issues. 50% of our patients have some sort of mental health or drug addiction issues. So while they may be living longer, there are immense challenges to living with HIV, accessing good health care, assuring that you have health care coverage are among them also. And there's no doubt it's important for people to protect themselves so that they don't have to face the challenges of living with HIV.
You mentioned briefly earlier three parts of a solution: better education for kids, access to condoms, and access to testing. Let's take those one at a time. When it comes to teaching kids, whether in schools or outside of schools, what do you think we need to be doing maybe that we're not doing now?
You know, it's interesting. The human growth and development curriculum in the state of Wisconsin is really set at the school board level. And there's 400 or so school boards in the state. And then on top of that, you have choice and charter schools and private schools, right? So it, at best, it is a patchwork approach to what our kids are learning about HIV and AIDS. As the father of three teenage daughters, I've seen what they learn in school, and it just simply isn't enough. We need to provide really candid, honest, scientifically accurate information to our young people. It's interesting. We equip them with information that will help them drive safely by wearing a seatbelt, and we equip them with information about the risks associated with cigarette smoking, and we educate them about the risks associated with drinking too much, but we're not doing the same thing when it comes to HIV and STIs, and that's what we need to do so that our kids can make good decisions and protect themselves.
There's, and I'm sure you've been following this for years, the ongoing debate in this country over sex ed and disease prevention training versus abstinence education. People who prefer abstinence education say teaching kids about safe sex is encouraging them to have sex. What do you say to that argument?
You know, I just would encourage people to look at the facts. And, for years, the CDC has conducted something called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it's deployed around the country. And in the state of Wisconsin, we've seen between 40 and 50% of our kids being sexually active. And, at that point, abstinence education just is not a meaningful way to reach out to those kids. Certainly, it can play a role in educating people who may make that choice, but we've got to do better. Our kids deserve better from us than that.
And then can you talk about access to condoms and to HIV and other STD testing?
Yeah, it's both condoms and HIV and STI testing access are really important. You know, in some schools, you have to go see the nurse in order to get a condom, and that is a tremendous barrier to a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid having to go talk to an adult before they can get condoms. You know, I recently had the opportunity to meet with an AIDS organization down in St. Louis, Missouri, and as part of that trip, I got to see some of the work that they were doing in a high school in St. Louis, and I was just stunned. There was a huge bowl, easily accessible to everybody, that literally had hundreds and hundreds of condoms in it. And it was clearly a don't ask. You know, it's available. We know that you're going to use it to protect yourself. And you know, they're just doing better for their kids with that sort of approach rather than putting up what are really artificial barriers to materials that can save their lives.
And we'll leave it there for now, Mike. Thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate it very much, Rob. Have a great day.
We've been talking to Mike Gifford. He's president and chief executive officer of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about an outbreak of HIV and other STDs in Milwaukee. First, maybe you've done some mountain climbing on a vacation to Colorado. Maybe you like to visit a local climbing gym here or there. Our next guest is a Wisconsin native who found herself living in a city surrounded by mountains, Santiago, Chile, and decided she wanted to be up there. Chelsea Berg grew up in Watertown and graduated from Marquette University. In January, she climbed to the top of Mount Aconcagua in Argentina. It's the tallest mountain outside of Asia. She writes about her travels and provides a guide to climbing Mount Aconcagua at findingthenorth.com. Chelsea, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to this mountain, I want to talk about how you got into mountain climbing. You grew up in a water town in Milwaukee, and Wisconsin is famous for a lot of things. Mountains isn't one of them. How did you get into mountain climbing?
Well, I would say that it's a family thing. I'm very, very, very close with my grandpa, and he loves the mountains. And my family in general, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, my parents, we're all very close. And so, you know, my grandpa loved the mountains, and then he passed it down to all of us. So we would take our summer vacations, you know, doing a road trip to California and camping, or when I was little, I would go to, you know, in the back of his truck, and we'd go to the mountains and camp for a week, and just always loved the mountains. So that was always instilled in my head since I was very, very little. So when I came to Chile, and all of a sudden I had literally the Andes Mountains, which is the longest mountain range in the world, I believe, and, you know, full of humongous mountains, and I look at them all day, every day as I'm walking down the road, it was like a dream come true.
Now tell us about this mountain, Aconcagua.
Aconcagua is the tallest mountain outside of Asia, which obviously is outside of the Himalayas, which is the mountains of Everest and, you know, all of the big 8,000 meter plus mountains. So Aconcagua is the tallest mountain in the world outside of that mountain range. It is also one of the seven summits, which is a circuit of mountains comprised of the tallest mountains on every continent. So Aconcagua at 22,842 feet, is the tallest mountain in South America and the tallest mountain here in the Western Hemisphere.
Now, you set out to climb this. You actually put up a time-lapse video of packing. And I have a hard time packing for, you know, a three-day road trip, talking about how important it is to pack well but not too heavy to climb a mountain like this.
Oh God. Well, we prepared and we planned for months before leaving for Aconcagua. And literally the packing was very important, because the thing with Aconcagua is you're starting and you're climbing through a valley which starts at around 9,000 feet above sea level. So you've got heat and you've got, you know, a beating sun. But then really quickly you start gaining altitude. So you need clothes for, you know, the sun and during the day on those times. But then as you get up, we're on the day of the summit, we were at -20, -25 degrees plus wind chill. So it was absolutely freezing. And all of the nights were absolutely freezing. And the thing that's crazy about Aconcagua was it's known for being very, very diverse in its climate and very extreme. So it changes from a sunny day 1 minute. Like, for example, we were at Camp 2 and it was sunny and we were having ramen noodles at 5,000 meters. And then half an hour later, we were in the middle of a snowstorm, couldn't see anything more than 10 feet in front of us, and it was freezing. So packing for the mountain is so important, because it is, you need to have the perfect amount of layers, highly technical clothes, so that you can accumulate layers without having to necessarily so much space. But we had about, the backpacks that we carried were around 55, 60 pounds at a time, and we always had the luggage that we had, the equipment that we had at camp was maybe 30 pounds. So it's a lot of weight. Every pound counts, and you don't want anything that you don't need.
Now, so people can get a picture of this. As I understand it, the approach, at least that you took up the mountain, this isn't one of those going up a stone face, chiseling handholds and things like that, right? It's a little different than that. Can you describe the ascent?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens is you have the first couple of days, you're walking through a very long valley, which is full of, it's pretty flat, the valley, and you're gaining altitude quite slowly. And the mountains are huge and very colorful on the sides. but you're going all the way through a valley to get to the base of the mountain. Once you get to the base of the mountain, which is at base camp, you then climb up from there, but you have very rocky paths, but it's constantly like you're walking on your 2 feet. With Aconcagua, it's not a technical mountain, which means that you don't need to use ropes or you know, climbing gear, because you're always on your 2 feet. But there are very steep inclines. There's a lot of snow, and you do a lot of zigzagging to help get you from one camp to the other. But you're consistently climbing and with just walking.
And this is still dangerous. I mean, while you were ascending, I think you wrote that you got news of two different people dying in the process of climbing the same mountain you were.
Yeah, that we got news on the third day, my third day into the climb, that somebody had passed away, and then also on my last day as well. What happens with Aconcagua is it's a non-technical climb, as I mentioned, where you don't need the ropes and you don't need climbing equipment. However, being a non-technical climb, people with low experience attempt. And I'm not saying that the two people who passed away in this case, it's a fault of their own or that they were inexperienced, because sometimes things also can happen. However, in general, what happens with Aconcagua is there's only a 30% success rate of people who are attempting the summit achieving the summit.
Wow.
And that happens because people who don't have the right experience, they aren't equipped to understand the extremities of the weather, of climatic changes, of the altitude and the way that the altitude affects your body. Because, for example, the person that passed away on my third day there, he passed away from a heart attack, which he was just a couple, I think he was around, you know, 1,000 feet from the summit. So, you know, your heart is beating very fast. Your body is under a lot of stress, under a lot of pressure. And you have to know what's the right kind of pace that you can move on so that you're taking your body and you're pushing your body, but not past the limit that you can't come back from. And the second person that passed away is also because of altitude. He developed an edema. So, you know, that happens from too much pressure in your brain or too much pressure in your lungs, which happens because of altitude. So, you know, anyone that wants to climb Aconcagua, you can do it, but you have to train and you have to understand what altitude means. You know, you have to be prepared for being in the sun and then all of a sudden being in a snowstorm and not being able to see or knowing what the route is. And you have to know how to manage, you know, those extreme situations. So it's very important, the planning and the logistics when doing a mountain that's non-technical, but still very extreme in terms of temperature and altitude.
Chelsea, you spent a long time training for this trip, preparing for this ascent, doing it, the exhaustion, the altitude, the cold, the weather. What was it like when you were at the summit, when you finally got there?
Well, I would definitely say I cried the last 15 minutes climbing to the summit. I was very under control the whole climb, very focused on, you know, just one foot in front of the other, achieving, breathing, moving forward, not giving up. And then all of a sudden, when I finally saw the summit and I realized that it was going to happen, I had been dreaming and planning this for so long. And there was, you know, the moments during the route that were hard and made me question, is this going to happen or not? And so when I saw that summit and I knew it was there, I had so much overwhelming energy that I just started bawling.
And
when you're bawling at 22,800 feet, it's not so easy because you're already struggling with breathing and then you start heaving on top of it. So, you know, I was like, Chelsea, get under control. But when I finally took the last step getting up to, and I stepped on the summit, my body was just such in like machine mode that was one foot in front of the other, breathing, keep going, that all of a sudden when I didn't need to, you know, keep taking more steps, all of a sudden, you know, the energy was just overwhelming, like coming out of, you know, my eyes. And, you know, I screamed and I looked all around. I felt like, you know, a kid in a candy shop, my eyes searching so quickly as if the view was going to vanish right before my eyes, and I couldn't get it all in. It was amazing because I was literally above every mountain. The mountains, there were so many mountains below, and I was above all of them, and I was above the clouds, you know. And I realized, you know, I just felt so humbled and so blessed and so proud. And I think that's a crazy thing about the mountain and how it gives you, you know, such a feeling of being so big and being so awesome. But at the same time, you know, Mother Nature and the world reminds you that you're nothing. And it's so so humbling, because I worked so hard to get there. But when you're on the top of the mountain, you realize how big the world is and the mountains are. It's so inspiring.
It's a great place to leave it. Chelsea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Chelsea Berg is a Wisconsin native who's been climbing mountains in Chile for the last 5 years. Most recently, she climbed the summit of Aconcagua in Argentina, one of the seven summits. You can find a guide she wrote to climbing Aconcagua and more about her travels at findingthenorth.com. Now, President Trump unveiled a series of initiatives yesterday in New Hampshire to combat the opioid crisis. He declared the opioid epidemic as a national public health emergency late last year. Initial estimates from the CDC show drug overdoses killed around 64,000 people in 2016. The new White House plan includes harsh penalties for drug dealers and for doctors who overprescribe the drugs. It also calls for allocating more money for research and development of non-opioid painkillers and an ad campaign to raise awareness. Our next guest is here to talk about the plan and some steps that state and federal governments can take to deal with the crisis. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System and has previously worked on task forces addressing opioid abuse and addiction. Dr. Eberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, did anything in particular stand out to you in the president's address and these plans announced yesterday?
There were several good points I thought made that we've been working locally, and one of the big ones is increasing the residential treatment reimbursement. Before, inpatient reimbursement residential treatment facilities were maxed at 16 beds to get actual money for it, and now they're going to drop that, and they can have more capacity, which has been a big hindrance, at least locally here in Wisconsin, for us to get people into treatment. So it's nice to see, looks like that's going away. That'll help a lot, actually, because we've really had trouble getting people into those appropriate residential treatment facilities.
And that's people who are already addicted, seeking treatment, maybe even wanting treatment, but not having that bed available to them in that inpatient facility. Is that right?
That's correct. Or some of the beds are hundreds, if not thousands of miles away for some people. And this will open up local resources to the point where hopefully we can start to make a dent on the amount of people that need treatment for this.
And are you hoping that this one, what sounds like a subtle change, might lead to more capacity, more facilities where they're needed instead of people having to go that hundreds of miles to get treatment?
Yeah, that is one that we came up locally as a task force with. That was a big problem as far as getting people into the treatment facilities that are close to them, that would be approved with their insurance and things like that. So I think that's going to help quite a bit, at least in the state of Wisconsin and locally here in La Crosse.
I want to look at some other aspects of the plan announced yesterday. Here's a listen to the president calling for more money to deal with the crisis.
And we've worked with Congress to ensure at least $6 billion additional dollars going through right now in new funding in 2018 and 2019 to combat the opioid crisis. And we will be spending the most money ever on the opioid crisis.
Dr. Eberlein, can you talk about federal funding levels? Is this, I've seen some people say this is great, but it doesn't go, won't go as far as you think. What do you think about this funding that's been passed by Congress?
Well, it's a lot more than we had before, so that's always good. It would be nice to actually see this money start to go towards treatment and prevention. But, you know, all, I think as a community, we'll take the money we can get for this, for sure, because we definitely need it. And it's going to be, as I mentioned before, a very expensive problem to fix. But it's been in the works. We've gotten to this point over years and years of multiple other layers of problems. And so now we've got to dig ourselves out of it. It's going to be expensive.
When we look at federal health care policy, what kind of changes from the Affordable Care Act to efforts to dial back the Affordable Care Act, what has all that meant for treatment of opioid addiction?
Well, I think some of it is because we've lost funding for some treatment programs. You know, people don't always have coverage, and that's always it's very expensive to take someone through a treatment program, and the more funding we get for that, the more options we have to get people into these programs and get them back on the road to recovery.
We were talking about President Trump's speech yesterday in New Hampshire, laying out a course of action on opioid addiction. Dr. Chris Eberlein is with us from Gunderson Health System. The president is also calling on for research and development of non-opioid painkillers. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
We're taking action to reduce drug demand by preventing Americans from becoming addicted in the first place. So important. That includes increasing federal funding for the development of non-addictive painkillers. And we have to come up with a solution where we come up with a painkiller that's not so addictive.
Is that an important part of the story? That's something I haven't heard talked about as much, Dr. Eberlein.
Yeah, it goes back to we really need to find better ways to treat patients' pain in general. And a lot of this we're going to see, hopefully see, and that's one of the goals that he talked about as well, is decreasing our overall prescription rate. And the goal that he set was a third reduction in narcotic prescriptions, I think he said, over the course of 2 or 3 years. And part of that, the only way to get there is going to be doing some of the steps you're already doing, the best practices for prescribing habits, utilizing the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program database, and that's the database that all providers can utilize to look at, see if a patient is receiving narcotics or sedatives from other providers. And one of the things that we're doing locally is it was often hard when you're seeing the patient to know exactly how much they're getting. And now there's a banner across the top on our medical record that if they're receiving over 50 milligram equivalents of morphine a day, there's a banner over the top that tells you that right away. So as a provider, you know almost instantaneously when you enter the chart if this patient would be at risk if you would prescribe more opiates. But that still doesn't fix the problem that 80% of our heroin users started with prescription drugs. And we need to have other modalities to treat their pain. And if we can come up with other medications that are as effective as opiates that aren't as addictive, that would be ideal. However, and I say that carefully because a lot of the drugs that we have now were initially billed as non-habit-forming and no abuse potential. But we all know that to be false. So we have to be careful that we actually get drugs that are truly non-addictive to replace the ones we have.
Right. In our toolkit now, we have the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, the ibuprofens and aspirins and whatnot that people are familiar with. There have been some studies that suggest that for some kinds of chronic pain, those drugs might have been as effective as the opioid-based drugs. What are we seeing out there when it comes to using other pain relievers that we already have?
Absolutely. In fact, there's been some pretty good evidence that the utilization of these non-steroidals, ibuprofen-type products and Tylenol, if you followed patients out for a couple of years, their quality of life and pain control was the same as those that were on opioids. So that's just another part of this educational component for our providers and for the patients that they have to realize that you know, these opiates are not a cure-all for pain. In fact, oftentimes you're no better off than had you been on these non-narcotic medications, and in a lot of ways you're worse because then you've got other problems.
Now, there are a lot of people, when you go to the comment sections on stories about cutting back on opioid medications, there are a lot of people out there who have had fairly traumatic instances, survived an accident or a very painful medical problem. They take some kind of opioid-based pain medication. They rely on it for the pain. Maybe they are also hooked on it now, and they may be in a position where they're losing that all of a sudden. And that can be a very dangerous time. How do we deal with the people who are in that very difficult position?
Yeah, I agree. It is. Some of these patients are in really tough spots, and I see them in the ER frequently. They've been now, their physicians certainly dial back on their narcotic usage. And if they're not mentally addicted, they have a dependence on these drugs. Their body is now dependent on them. And we know that change occurs in some people fairly rapidly when they initiate these drugs. And so this is where close monitoring with your primary physician who is prescribing these drugs, talking to your primary physician about your concerns with this, and looking at different ways to treat your pain, and appropriate tapering of these medications is really going to be something that's going to have to be worked through our system. And it's going to be, these are going to be longer appointments. It's going to take more time. And we're going to need more providers trained on how to safely get patients off of these drugs onto other types of pain control, and yet to not have them have this time period where they're in a lot of discomfort, because no provider wants to see their patients in pain. And what we want to do is taper them off of these medications that could be more harmful to something that isn't as harmful and hopefully is more effective for them.
Do we have the time and the resources, the medical staff available to deal with this? Because if not, I mean, we hear the stories again and again. That's the point where people turn to the black market, a heroin or an illegal synthetic fentanyl or something like that.
Absolutely. And the time it's going to take is going, and that's where hopefully some of the $6 billion will start to come through, is to help these patients get the help they need and to support some of the providers in getting the patients off these. And that's going to be through education and training and, more physical therapy referrals, chiropractic, acupuncture. I mean, there's all these other modalities that we can utilize to help these patients out. And a lot of them sometimes aren't covered currently. We're going to have to relook at how we cover these sorts of treatments.
Talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein from Gunderson Health System right now, looking at President Trump's proposed plan to fight opioid addiction and sales in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's plan, what we've talked about so far? He's also talking about crackdowns on illegal drug dealers and providers who overprescribe medications, calling for a pretty significant cuts in the amount of opioid drugs prescribed. If you or someone you know are in this position relying on opioids for pain management, what concerns do you have? What help do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about President Trump's address on the opioid crisis yesterday. Our guest is Dr. Chris Eberlein. He's an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. He has worked on opioid task forces. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What response would you like to see from the White House, from the federal government on the opioid crisis? What do you think of what President Trump has said and done so far? How have you seen this affect your community, maybe your family, maybe your own life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Eberlein, enforcement was a big part of what the president had to say yesterday. Here is a listen to that part of his speech.
Whether you are a dealer or doctor or trafficker or a manufacturer, if you break the law and illegally peddle these deadly poisons, we will find you, we will arrest you, and we will hold you accountable.
I know law enforcement isn't the main part of what you work on, but what are your thoughts on that part of the president's address?
I've talked to, working on the local task force, a lot of our local law enforcement. They need more support, and so clearly they're going to be looking at getting more support from the federal government to help with this. And the synthetic opioids that are coming into the country are a real problem. We've been seeing this. Locally, we've had our first carfentanil death not long ago, And you know, these drugs are incredibly dangerous, and there's a big concern amongst even first responders and responding to these calls and going into houses and treating patients that they would become exposed to this too. So it is a problem, and enforcement, you know, this is a multifactorial problem that's going to take a lot of different resources and groups to solve it.
Let's go to our callers now. Penny is with us in Black River Falls. Penny, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, my husband has ALS, and he's atypical. He's been dealing with it for over a decade, and I just don't see how a non-opioid painkiller would work for somebody with a fatal, debilitating disease. I also watched my mother die of cancer. So with these fatal diseases that are so extremely painful, I just don't see how, like, non-opioid steroid painkillers are going to work for these people.
Penny, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your mom, and best of luck for you and your husband. And Dr. Everline, that's initially what these drugs were out there for, right? People with very painful and probably terminal conditions. Is that right?
That is correct. And I feel sorry for what her family's going through. Very difficult diseases to handle, that is for sure. Initially, these were for cancer patients, cancer pain, and they will always play a role. There are going to be some patients, and it's going to be more case by case, that will not get good pain control without narcotics. And this is where that case by case discussion with your primary doctor, your oncologist, hospice, things like that, that, you know, we don't want to see these patients suffer. And these are the patients that are most appropriate for some of these drugs. And we're going to have to make sure as we go on that these patients aren't left behind.
Penny, thanks for the call. Go next to Steve in Palmyra. Steve, hi.
Hi. Yeah, in regards to this opioid thing, and this is a terrible thing. I went through it myself. I've had a couple of family members go through it. And I want to tell you, the withdrawals were just unimaginable. I had no idea, you know, what I was in for. Had I known, obviously, I wouldn't have gotten myself where I did. I mean, I've been clean going on 6-7 months now. But, I mean, it was, I thought I wanted to die. It was just unbelievably sickening. And it's so sick. I never been that sick in my life.
Steve, thank you for calling. 6 months clean, I think you said. Best of luck as you continue with that. Dr. Eberlein, the withdrawal, and I'm sure you've seen this, the withdrawal, famously difficult and hard. This is not an easy thing to get out of.
It's not. And the withdrawal can be so bad that you will get patients that are overdosed, and after they get Narcan, they'll tell you they wish that you hadn't done that because that puts them into an immediate withdrawal. So that, I mean, it kind of gives you an idea how painful and uncomfortable some of these withdrawal symptoms are. And this is something that it's somewhat treatable. And there will always be a little bit withdrawal as someone comes off these drugs, but it can be managed with other medications and with close monitoring and tapering of these medications.
Thanks a lot for the call. And again, good luck to you. Sharon is with us next in Madison. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of back with Penny. I'm curious. I also have been taking opioids for probably 10 years, prescription of 15 milligrams in total a day. One day I might take 5 milligrams. I might not take anything for 2 or 3 days. There may be a day where I need to take 10. Or 15. I never exceed that. I don't feel that I have an issue. Are there people that don't have to have a problem when used appropriately?
Sharon, thanks for the call. And Dr. Eberlein, of course, we won't ask you to diagnose anyone on the phone, but your thoughts on long-term use of, I guess that's a lower dose of opioids.
Yeah, she's actually on a pretty low dose. It doesn't even come up to the getting flagged in the medical record yet, which is good, and I'm glad that's controlling her symptoms. And it's purely going to be a case-by-case with your primary provider. If this is something that's working for you, I don't think any of us are saying that these drugs should never be prescribed, ever. We're just saying that for those that other treatment modalities work, and we know that the U.S. does consume about 90% of these narcotics. So we know there's significant overprescribing. However, some patients will need these drugs to lead their productive lives.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. We'll go next to George in Beaver Dam. George, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I retired from the military, and I had messed up my back pretty bad. I'd been in the war four times. I've been on a steady dose for like 6 years, and, you know, it just doesn't – I know there's a huge issue with it because I also work in healthcare, but I'm wondering if there's any studies that show the percentage of people that actually are at risk developing, you know, addiction versus those who just stay on a regular dose and are happy with it. Because I, in the blogs and stuff I follow, I see a lot of guys who are worried about this and being cut off.
George, thanks for the call. Dr. Eberlein, research on who is maybe more prone to become addicted?
Not good research. We have not yet come up with that magic survey to tell us that you're at high risk and you're not. You know, there are some clues. Obviously, there appears to be a genetic component. It tends to, you have multiple addicted patients in one family, or clearly someone else in that family would be at higher risk. If you had addiction problems with other alcohol and other things before, you might be at higher risk. But there is not good evidence there. And patients that are on these drugs chronically, what we're doing is we're trying to look at and see if it is appropriate for a patient and if there's other things that we can do to help them take a medication that isn't as dangerous to them.
Very briefly, Dr. Eberlein, for people taking that long-term opioid medication, might it be a good time to say, talk to their doctor and see if they can come up with a plan to see if there's another option?
For sure. And that's really what we're looking at, is take a look at the patient's whole picture, figure out what is the best treatment program for them. Some of them will need narcotics to control their pain, but there's a lot of others that probably don't, and they may have not even tried other things that might work well for them. And that's what we really have to look at.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. He joined us today to talk about President Trump's proposed plans to combat the opioid crisis. The president spoke on that issue yesterday in New Hampshire.